Okay, so I want to talk about metta-bhavana this morning, and the metta is the root practice of the Brahmaviharas. So all the other Brahmaviharas come out of metta, meeting particular circumstances. So for instance, Karuna comes out of metta, meeting suffering. Mudita comes out of metta, meeting other people's happiness or joy. And as I said last night, the Brahmaviharas are practiced in the Mahayana as the practices for the development of the bodhicitta. They're the root practices for that. In the Hinayana, the Ivitikaka speaks of metta as outshining the sun and stars. And it says it makes the fetters thin. It leads to liberation. So it's clear that the Brahmaviharas, and metta in particular, are not just preliminary practices. They can actually go all the way to liberation, as the Metta Sutta makes clear. And I've read quite a lot of books on the Brahmaviharas, and the only book that I've found that does justice to its profundity and depth is actually Living with Kindness. I keep going back to that book again and again and again. So eventually, metta will lead to transcendence of subject and object. At its highest level, it can go all the way. But to start with, and for quite a long time, it's more like ordinary human friendliness. Cultivating ordinary human friendliness, down to earth, care and concern, interest and willingness to connect with people. And there are no shortcuts, really. In a way, you have to practice it on the cushion and off the cushion, if you want to develop metta. And I think it's one of those practices that you only really feel the benefits of it if you practice it regularly. In a way, it's a very, very positive habit that you're getting into cultivating. And on that, in the Dhammapada, it talks about irrigators running off water and Fletcher straightening arrows and the wise disciplining themselves. And I was very struck by this image of irrigators running off water. I didn't really understand it until once I was in the south of Spain. I was in Andalusia, and I was walking around in the winter in the fields. And I noticed these drainage channels that people had cut, the farmers had cut in the earth, leading to individual fruit trees. And so when the rain fell, the water would be channeled to the fruit trees, it would nourish the fruit trees would bear fruit, and so on. And it's really like that with our emotions. If we don't do anything about our emotions, they just run off. Perhaps they don't even penetrate the soil, and they just get wasted. Maybe sometimes positive emotions arise by chance, they dissipate, then the opposite occurs, and so on and so forth. So a major part of spiritual life is actually working with our emotions, developing our emotions, cultivating our emotions, and learning to channel our emotions. And I think this is what the Metta-bhavana and the Brahmaviharas really does. It's a way of actually channeling our emotions so it nourishes our being, so that our being can burst into fruit and into flower. And we need to keep doing it again and again. I think something very important about metta is it's not just a pleasant feeling. It's a weighty karma. It's a weighty karma. It's a tendency of our being, a tendency of our mind, that we need to keep cultivating again and again and again. And if we do that, it really will bear fruit. But it will bear fruit over time. And of course, it's not going to be enough just to do the metta-bhavana on the cushion. It needs to be actually expressed outside of meditation. And I think a large part of expressing metta is to do with our imagination. It's to do with being able to actually identify with another person, imaginatively, with their own set of needs and their own reality, which is different from ourselves, and to be able to take that into consideration. And then do that again and again and again with more and more people. In a way, it's the antidote to egocentricity. The idea that everything revolves around us, everything comes back around us. So, in a way, the essence of the spiritual life is that we're moving away from egocentricity. That's really what insight means. It means that one's moving away from this idea that one's the centre of the universe. Everything revolves back to oneself. And spiraling outwards and upwards and including more and more people. So, metta leads all the way to insight and beyond, all the way to liberation, but it has to be cultivated, first of all, in ordinary human friendliness and kindness, and acts of kindness, words of kindness, thoughts of kindness. So I want to talk a little bit about some of the principles of metta, then I want to go through the stages. The first thing I want to say about this is that I think sometimes we make metta much more cluttered and much more complicated than it need be. Metta is an absorption, so it's something you're trying to get absorbed in. And your mind, ideally, when you're doing metta, should be quite spacious. You don't need to use a lot of concepts. If you use the phrases, you use them sparingly. I think the first thing we probably need to do for most of us is just to listen. You know, just to listen to our experience and tune into our experience and tune into whatever seeds of metta are already there. You know, and the metta is a composite emotion. So it could be, you know, some feeling of helpfulness, confidence, kindness, care, just a feeling of joy. Any of those positive emotions. Just tuning into them and giving them attention. And whatever the mind tends towards, that you become, that will grow. We probably have to work on the other side as well. I think, or speak for myself, I'm very, very good at finding faults with people. I'm very good at finding what's wrong in a situation. And I think it needs discipline. Discipline with one's thoughts and actually not giving energy to criticism and fault finding, but consciously deciding to give energy to encouragement and enthusiasm on and off the cushion. So you just start by tuning into whatever positive emotions are there, and it can be quite spacious. I think it's very important that we have confidence in our positive emotions. Maybe one of the ways that people go wrong in the metta is to think of metta as some exalted state that's beyond them, while not recognising the positive emotions that they already have. And I've seen this sometimes on retreat when I've done meditation reviews and somebody's been telling me that they find it really difficult to contact metta, but I just see them around the place and they're very helpful, you know, they're looking out for other people and so on and so forth. So sometimes it's just learning to recognise and have confidence in the positive emotions that you already have, and then giving energy to that, consciously giving energy to that, and allowing it to grow. So there's this receptive side to metta, and that's very important. And I remember talking to Banti some time ago and about meditation, and he was saying that he thought there were two aspects to any meditation practice. There's making effort, cultivating, and then relaxing and experiencing the fruits of the effort. So maybe you're actively trying to cultivate metta. Within the metta practice, sometimes it's good then, after a period of actively trying to cultivate metta, just to relax, let go, and just allow yourself to experience the fruits of the effort that you've made. A bit more effort, relaxing, experiencing the fruits. And of course, this is what we do more generally with the just sitting practice, interspersed with the more active practices. So it's okay to use the phrases, but use them sparingly. And if you use them, make sure that they're coming from the heart, that they're connected with the emotion. So it's more like a heart wish for the other person's happiness and for their growth. In more technical terms, metta is an emotion. An emotion is a feeling plus a volition. So metta isn't just about passively enjoying pleasant feelings. Like I said, it's a karma. It's something you cultivate. So there's an emotion, there's a feeling aspect to it, but there's also a volitional aspect to it. And they're both important. In a way that the feeling is the juice of the practice, but the volition is the directionality of the practice, and it needs both. It's a karma that you're cultivating. It's something that will actually modify you over time. It's a tendency that you're setting up. I think a big mistake I made with the metta bhavana was when I first took it up, I had a lot of very blissful experiences, and I spent about 3 years trying to get back to those experiences. And of course it didn't come, you know, because what's happened is that your meditation practice has gone deeper, and there's more of you engaged, and there's more of you that you're trying to transform. And you don't really know what's going on in your meditation practice. A lot of the time, there's a lot of transformation going on that's happening below the surface. And, you know, there may be quite long periods where your meditation is quite dry and quite barren. And it may be that at times you can't do very much about that, except have confidence in the law of karma and have confidence that the efforts that you're making, as long as they're intelligent, appropriate, are going to bear fruit. So what you need to do is you need to tune into your experience at the beginning of the practice. And you need to get a sense of what you're working with. And there's not very much you can do about that. That's your raw material. And you just work with that. And you try to make it more aware, more helpful, more skillful, more other orientated. So you're just trying to strengthen this whole tendency of your being to be more helpful, more friendly, more aware of others. And you work with whatever's there, and you just take the next step from whatever the meditation presents you with. And it's going to be different from one practice to another. And a good meditator is really somebody who can work appropriately with whatever arises. So you have to be prepared to work from where you are. That's the only place you can work from in the metta bhavana. My next point is that low-key metta is okay. It may not be a big experience. It's quite okay to work with quite low-key metta. A lot of our experience outside of meditation is like that. You know, if we're not stimulating ourselves or distracting ourselves, a lot of our experience is quite low key, and that's what you're going to meet in the practice some of the time. And you just work with that. And spiritual emotions aren't always very exciting. They're calm, and they're subtle, and they can be strong, but they're not the same as worldly emotions like lust or hatred. They're quite subtle, and you need a subtle mind to work with that, so you need to tune into that. And at first it may present itself as quite low-key, but it's quite subtle. Okay, next, metta's a wise emotion. It's not just a friendly feeling. It also involves imaginatively identifying with the other person, actually taking them in, taking in their reality, which is different from your own. Bhante's got this phrase, love is the awareness of the being of another person. I think that's very important. It's not just a feeling, it's an awareness of the being of another person. And as you practice, as you go on with your practice, what you bring to the metta bhavana is going to change. So as the Dharma becomes more part of your being, you're going to be able to bring more of it to the metta bhavana. So your idea of what happiness is going to change, and what you're going to be wishing the other person is going to change. You're going to see that pleasure is not going to be enough. That happiness, what you're wishing the person is that they have some meaning in their life, that they actually grow as individuals, they develop as individuals. And as your Dharma practice deepens, you're going to see what really constitutes happiness. You're going to be aware of the three lakshanas. You're going to be aware of impermanence. You're going to be aware of karma and so on. And all that's going to feed into your practice. So the Tibetans have this phrase, may all beings have happiness and its causes. In other words, happiness doesn't occur by chance. It occurs through as a byproduct of skillful states of mind. So that's what you're actually wishing the other person and wishing yourself. Okay, well, I want to go through the stages very briefly. And I think it's very important to go through the stages in the classical metta bhavana, because you confront different relationships with people. You confront your friends, you confront your indifference, you confront your hostility and aversion. And you have to be very honest with yourself. You have to be very honest about your responses. And it addresses your emotions in a much, much broader way if you go through the practice in the classical stages. So we start with ourselves, and there are different ways you can do this, and I've mentioned a couple of ways. One is just to tune in with whatever seeds of positive emotion are already there. There are other ways as well, which I'm sure you're familiar with, and we can talk more about this in the groups. One way I particularly like is to connect with self-cherishing. So you connect with the fact that just below the surface, you really care about yourself. You really care about your own happiness. It's important to you. You care that you care about your own growth. In fact, it's the most important thing. If we're really honest, our own happiness, our own growth is the most important thing in our lives. And the only thing is, we're not always very intelligent or skillful about seeking our own happiness, and quite often it brings us suffering. But that's what we really want. We want to feel happy, we want to feel fulfilled, we want to feel that we're growing and realising our potential. And however we behave, you know, even if we're making a complete idiot of ourselves, that's what we want. That's what motivates us deep down. So we need to drop below the surface and tune in with that level of our being that wants our true happiness, wants us to grow, to develop, to be fulfilled, and just connect with that and dwell on that and recognize that. It's not that difficult to tune in with that level. It's just that it's always there. It's just below the surface. And really wish ourselves well in that way. And then in the other stages, we just recognise, well, that is just like that for everybody else. Everybody wants happiness. Everybody wants to grow, to feel fulfilled. however deluded the ways that they're going about it are, and they're just like us in that respect. They want to avoid suffering, they want to be happy and fulfilled, and we just wish them that. We wish that they'd be fulfilled, we wish that they'd be happy. They're just like us. So we feel this essential solidarity with other people in relation to happiness and suffering. So that's one way of doing the practice, and one way of going into the first stage. Okay, so the second stage, the good friend. I know sometimes people don't find the first stage easy, and if you don't find it easy, you might try swapping them around. You might try putting the good friend in first and then going to yourself in second. That can work quite well too. Traditionally, you choose a teacher or a Kalyana Mitra in this stage. But it could just be a really good friend. I think we're very, very fortunate in our movement that we have this emphasis on friendship, because many people don't have friendship. They don't have access to real friends. And a friend is a real blessing. If you've got a real friend, someone you share your life with, someone who cares about you, you care about them, you've got a blessing. You've got a real blessing. And you can dwell on that blessing. And Ayakema says that one of the best ways into metta is through gratitude. So you can feel gratitude to to your friend or your Kalyana Mitra or whoever you put in that second stage. You can feel the blessing of their friendship and dwell on that. And just get absorbed in that. Get absorbed in your gratitude, your friendliness, your wish for the happiness of your friend. And metta is an absorption. And the whole idea is that in the first two stages, and particularly maybe in the friend stage, you get absorbed in the emotion of metta, and then you're able to carry it in on to the other stages. And if you find yourself losing the practice in the other stages, you can come back to the friend, or you can come back to your own self-metta. So the third stage is the neutral person. And I think the particular thing we're going to need to work with in the third stage is our own indifference, our own boredom, our own lack of interest. But the third stage actually is incredibly inspiring. The neutral person is incredibly inspiring because most people are neutral people. Most of the world are neutral to us. Most people don't directly affect our lives in terms of benefiting us or threatening us, which the friend and the enemy do. So there's actually very little self-interest in the neutral person. And we'll find out later when we come to do the Upekkha Bhavana. The second stage in the Upekkha Bhavana is the neutral person, because there's very little self-interest. So in this stage, you need to actually acknowledge your indifference. You need to acknowledge your lack of interest. What I suggest you do to make it easier for you is to choose someone that's very familiar, but you don't have any strong feelings for or against. Could be someone on the retreat, someone you can actually take in outside of meditation, you're aware of outside of meditation, someone you may even have some interaction with on the retreat. So you choose someone who's familiar, but you don't have any strong feelings for. And a lot of the practice in that stage, I think, is just to keep coming back and looking for interest in the neutral person. It's a bit like if you're trying to communicate with somebody who you find really boring, and you keep drifting off, and you have to keep bringing the mind back and trying to engage and trying to draw something really positive out of the communication, trying to make the communication worthwhile, make it more interesting for you as well as for them. So you keep bringing the mind back and you keep looking for interest. And it's remarkable in this stage, because if you keep doing that, sooner or later you find something about that person that you engage with, and then you're off and you're into the practice. And if you can't find anything else, if you don't know anything about them, again, you can just reflect, well, they're just like you. You know, they want to be happy, they want to be fulfilled, they want to avoid suffering. They're just like you in that respect. And if they're on the retreat, well, you can just rejoice in the fact that they're on the retreat. You know, you can feel metta for the fact that they're here trying to develop the Brahma Viharas. Okay, so the enemy. It's said, Buddhaghosa says that if you haven't got an enemy, you can put another neutral person in this stage, which just shows the importance of the neutral person. So maybe you don't have an outright enemy, but maybe there's someone who irritates you. There's bound to be someone who irritates you, someone that you'd rather not be left sort of in a sitting opposite on a long train journey with, something like that. So first of all, the first thing to do is to acknowledge what the difficulty is. Acknowledge that there is a difficulty, that there is something that you find difficult about that person, or they find difficult about you. And then just broaden out, you know, and just say, well, okay, there's that, but what more is there? What more is there to that person? And try to see the whole person. And it's worth saying that hatred isn't to do with seeing the faults of somebody else. It's quite all right to see somebody's faults objectively. It's when you only see their faults. That's what hatred is. When you don't see the whole person, you just see their faults. So you're trying to bend the bamboo the other way and see the whole person, see their good qualities, as well as acknowledging the difficulty. And then you just wish them well. And if you find you're really stuck in hatred, it's quite good, it's quite worthwhile just asking yourself, do I really want this? You know, and look at the effect that the hatred or the irritation is having on you. Because hatreds regard it as a very dangerous emotion, because it separates us from other people. And it's anti-sangha. It's impossible to create sangha where there's hatred. So it separates you from others. Okay, so we come to the last stage, and that's in two parts. First of all, breaking the barriers. So that's bringing together oneself and the other three people. And I usually imagine us sitting in a circle and just going round the circle, taking each person in, and just looking for a more equal love, a more equal friendliness and helpfulness. And then expanding outwards. And the main quality you're looking for here in this last stage is one of expansion. In a way, it's an expansion of your being. When you're really absorbed in metta, you feel your whole being expanding. That's incidentally why the metta is a very good basis for doing the sadhana practice, because you're cultivating a very expansive state of mind, which is akin to the clear blue sky at the beginning of the sadhana practice. So you're focusing on this quality of expansion. And maybe just start with the people in the room, the people meditating with you. Sometimes I even open my eyes in this last stage and just look at people and take them in, and then close them again and just dwell on the people who are in front of me. But first of all, just try to get a sense of the people meditating with you. Then if you want to expand outwards, just expand out into the world. And I think metta is a sort of it's a force in a way. It's more than just empathy. It's a force in a way that the mind is very powerful. And it's a force that's being let loose into the world, a force for the good that's going out into the world. And it's definitely affecting our environment. Mm. And it's definitely affecting the people that are around us. Quite recently, I was up at Adisthana, and Bhante's been very ill recently. And someone came up with a suggestion that we should, I think it was Subhuti, that we should all do 15 minutes of metta for Bhante every morning when we're sitting, everybody's sitting in the shrine room at Adisthana. And that's what we did. And after a few days, Bhante said that he really appreciated it and he could feel the effects of people's metta on him. So metta does have an effect. It does affect the world. It's a force let loose in the world. And I find it very useful in this respect too, just to bring to mind the trouble spots in the world. You know, we all watch the news. We know some of the stuff that's going on. Just bring that to mind. Bring those people to mind. Maybe it makes a difference. Who knows? You know. But really think of it as, well, you know, you're not impotent in that respect. You can affect the world, and you can affect the world through the Metta Bhavana practice and the other Brahma Viharas. You're adding to the force of good in the world through these practices. I think that's very, very important to take into account. Okay. So each Brahma Vihara has got a far enemy and a near enemy. And the far enemy of metta is hatred. And like I said, it's a very dangerous emotion because it separates us from our own positive emotions and it separates us from other people. And not only that, if you're in a teaching situation and you're prone to hatred or to anger, people become frightened of you. And it's very difficult to hear the Dharma from you if people are frightened of you. So very, very important to work on anger and to work on hatred. Okay, the near enemy is Pema. And Pema covers quite a range. And Pema is our working ground. So very often with the Brahma Viharas, you're going to be developing the Brahma Vihara itself. You're also going to be working with the far enemy and the near enemies, and particularly with the near enemies. So very often near enemy is our raw material. It's our worldly emotions that we're trying to find some sort of spiritual equivalent to. So Pema is attachment, it's fear of loss. We're attached, but people change, they grow old, they drift apart, they move away, and eventually they die. And we suffer because of that. So we need to go deeper into metta. And metta endures beyond change. It even endures beyond death. It's possible to have a relationship with people beyond death through metta. Pema is everything from healthy affection to strong neurotic attachment. And we're going to encounter both in the practice. So it's the raw material. And in a way, it's a Pema. In some senses, can be a positive worldly emotion. It's self-interested. It's towards our family, our social group, that which gives us security, stability, reciprocity. On the other hand, metta, in its purest sense, is without attachment. It's without self-interest. There's no need for reciprocity, and it's not limited to family or friends or any particular group of people. So obviously we can't just move straight to metta in the purest sense. So very often in the metta bhavana, we're going to be working with Pema in its different forms, and looking for a less self-interested response. So we need to acknowledge the near enemies, and we need to work with them, and we need to move them somewhere along the scale from Pema towards Metta. So that's something about the practice. There's a lot more that could be said. Maybe I'll say a few things later on in the retreat. But I'll just take a few questions for now practical questions about the practice, if anyone wants to ask anything. Yeah.
I often find with the neutral person, one way of trying to cultivate engagement is to imagine their lives. But in a way, I've never been quite sure how far to take that, because of course it gets into a kind of fantasy.
Yeah.
And it's not real.
Yeah.
And I've never been quite, I mean, I felt quite safe with doing that. And I could see that there could be a problem in imagining something and believing that imagination.
Yeah.
And not being able to let go.
Yeah. What I tend to do with the neutral person is to look for the facts. Mm-hmm. You know, so actually somebody on the retreat, then I just look at the way that they, the way they are around the retreat centre and notice qualities and so on, you know, or that maybe they've got a lovely smile or something like that.
Yeah.
So I try to keep it as close as I can to, you know, direct observation, but... But because I think there is a danger of making, you know, this is what I was saying earlier, I think there's a danger of making the practice too cerebral,
yeah.
You know, and it's really about contacting a particular emotion, and like everything that you're doing in the practice is strengthening that and helping you to become more absorbed in that. So I suppose a simple test would be, does it take you away from that or does it strengthen it? It's the difference between imagination and fantasy,
yeah,
in a way.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Any more?
We just relate to that. I mean, suppose you do imagine their life and it's nothing like their life, but it leads to a feeling of terrible life. Does it matter?
Well, I don't know, but I mean, sooner or later, hopefully you'll get to know the person. I don't know, and you'll have a more real picture of them. But I think metta in the full sense is where you really can imaginatively identify with what their actual life is like. So I suppose it might be all right for a start, but it's got a limitation, I suppose. I mean, there are people that I know quite well that I can still put in the neutral stage. You know, even people that I've lived with in the past, you know, that I can put in the neutral stage. Possibly there's even someone in your own family. Yes.
We're also saying these are practices that can take us,
yes,
all the way. So can you say something about those,
yeah,
two?
Yeah,
things?
Yeah, 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 yeah. I suppose there are probably two levels of the practice. So I suppose at an ordinary level, you know, they're Brahma Viharas, aren't they? So they're union with Brahma. So it's like being in heaven on earth. In the sense that they're the peak of emotional maturity, and they're emotions that are not only positive but appropriate to the situation. But it seems that, for example, in the last stage of the Metta Bhavana, if you genuinely felt an equal love towards all the people that came to mind, you would have transcended subject and object, at least for that time. And that would be tantamount to an insight, an experience of insight. So I think we have to get away from seeing insight purely in conceptual terms, you know, and also see it in emotional terms or even in devotional terms sometimes. I think the Brahma Viharas are an emotional approach to insight, that actually directly involves our relationships with other people as well.